Hey everyone, so the episode ran a little bit longer than we expected, so we're splitting episode 2.2 into two pieces. We ended up recording about 40 minutes of a really intense discussion, so I've cut it roughly in the midpoint where I could, and the second episode will go up next week. There's a lot of really interesting stuff and we really appreciate comments, but anywho, here we go.
It's one small step for man,
but the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 2.2.
Nibbling on rainbow flavored planets because they provide your daily source of fiber and hopefully make you regular.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And this episode, we're actually talking about an interesting thing that came up through the Locus roundtables. I guess they started them up again. So it's the, it's, you describe it, Jen. How would you describe this? It's sort of like a series of discussions about.
A series of posts about the aesthetics of science fiction. What makes science fiction beautiful as opposed to fiction?
Right. Yeah. As opposed to regular fiction or what is it that is unique? Beautiful and unique about science fiction, and they're fairly brief, and a number of them, the panelists, includes a lot of critics and some writers, they don't really go anywhere with it because they sort of assume that if there is something unique, it's unattainable or that you can't market, you can't say this is it.
This is the thing that makes science fiction beautiful, that makes it somehow separate from fiction.
Right, right. So it's very interesting, though, and this is all springboarded off of something Damian G. Walter wrote over at IO9. And I do think it's really interesting, though, because I've read parts of The Seven Beauties of Science Fiction by István Csitri Róné, I believe his name is pronounced. And that's actually a really interesting book, but they're not so much... they're aesthetic, but they're not really aesthetic... He's not talking about aesthetics in the same sense, I think, as they're talking about here, although someone brings him up. So it is, I don't know, like, what about science fiction can be beautiful other than the fact that it, in the movies, it's pretty?
Well, I mean, specifically what Damian's talking about is, he thinks, the title of his post is, to be true, science fiction must be beautiful, and there's this whole thing about science versus art, and that can science be beautiful, or is only art beautiful? And it's one of those what's crap and what's not argument for science fiction, and also in terms of comparing it to fiction, because traditionally people who write fiction or critique fiction will say that science fiction is, you know, slightly hackneyed crap and cannot actually ever be beautiful because everybody who writes it apparently doesn't appreciate beauty, which is obvious. I mean, this is like kind of an older criticism. People are coming around to the fact that science fiction can be beautiful, but the real question becomes what makes something beautiful and can science fiction ever reach that point? And obviously those of us who read science fiction go, well, yes, duh. Obviously, there is some beautiful science fiction out there. And one of the posts actually came to the point, though, was that's not actually the interesting question of whether or not science fiction can be beautiful, because obviously, at least to you and I, science fiction is beautiful.
Or can be.
Can be. I mean, somebody quoted something about 90% of science fiction is crap.
Oh, it's the Sturgeon quote. That's a popular quote, that 90% of all science fiction is crap. And then some people like to add on that, or I may have been Sturgeon that added this, but it always seems like somebody else is adding it, that he also says that 90% of everything is crap. So
right, exactly.
Which is true. I mean, 90% of everything is crap. 90% of the electronics you buy are crap compared to the one super electronic. So,
exactly. So yeah. The more interesting question becomes, because it's asked, what is it that makes fiction beautiful in the first place? And Damien's answer is that the great strength of prose fiction is its ability to step inside the human experience, to explore the internal world that exists inside us all. When science fiction is beautiful, it is most often because, however strange the external world it explores, its first concern is with the internal experience of that world. That may be true. I don't know if that's necessarily the only thing that makes fiction beautiful. It is definitely, to me, one of the things that makes good fiction beautiful. But
that sounded like a really, really long-winded way to say that it, because it deals with the human condition.
The human condition, exactly, which it pretty much is. And to me, a lot of science fiction deals with the human condition.
I think a lot of fiction in general does.
A lot of fiction in general does.
That
right.
Science fiction deals with it in slightly... Well, I mean, a lot of science fiction is technological, or technology plays a role in why the world is the way that it is. So it's a different kind of dealing with the human condition. I mean, a regular fiction sort of deals with typically I don't want to say mundane, but that's the only word I can think of, since some stuff that is in regular fiction is not really mundane, like colonialism is not really mundane, but you know, it's dealing with
the day-to-day, the things that we expect to find in the human condition.
Right, and something that's immediately tangible. And I guess that's what's interesting about science fiction is that it can deal with things that are related to what's tangible, but that they're also new experiences. But then there's also the problem that, well, now the present is encroaching on the future. So a lot of the stuff that science fiction used to deal with that weren't so prevalent in terms of the dealing with the human condition are now happening. So it's interesting too, because then what happens with regular fiction, because that might also pull forward as well, and then become about the same things as science fiction is. And then what is it that separates science fiction from
the fiction? Right. That is a very good question. I think, I mean, what becomes the interesting question at least to Paul Graham Raven, he asks, is whether fiction that partakes in science fiction can produce the internal experience of the world in a way that fiction that doesn't partake in science fiction cannot achieve. So that really is to him at least the more interesting question here. It's not whether or not, you know, it's capable of doing that, because it obviously is, but can it do it in ways that a normal prose fiction story cannot? And one of those ways theoretically is that, you know, going forward into the future and exploring the non-mundane as it applies to the human condition, or even not as it applies to the human condition, but as it applies to just stuff in general, but somehow still comes around to being about the human condition, if that makes any sense.
Well, it is. Science fiction, it's just dealing with aspects of the human condition that aren't happening yet.
Right, that aren't happening yet. But it can do that. What I'm saying is that it can do that not by exploring specifically the human being's experience of that condition. It can create worlds in which the world itself and the science...
Oh, is a character in a way.
Is a character in a way. And, you know, it's just like, you know, certain authors, somebody cites Dickens later on, but Dickens uses the city as a character, you know, to explore the human condition. He also is exploring the human beings within that city. But if you took the human beings out of Dickens, you would still have an absolutely fascinating exploration of the human condition, because you have this deep, you know, this dark, gritty city to deal with. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, it's the difference between dealing with the human condition and the individual, and dealing with it in the plural.
Kind of, yes.
Well, it is, because when you're talking about a city, the city isn't, I think like Perdido Street Station, which is not technically science fiction, but we can throw in fantasy into this discussion too, because I think it's also relevant. Perdido Street Station, I mean, it takes place in this one city, and it's a very detailed city, and the city itself is its own kind of character, populated with all kinds of beings. Granted, they're not all human, but whatever. It's fantasy. Give me a break. But so while it also deals with individuals, it's also dealing with a city that
the collective
collective entity and how it reacts, or individual groups that react within a collective location. So if you take out the Isaac and Lynn, and you take out the people that we get to know personally, the story still, I mean, it changes, but it still functions because there's still an examination, but it's now more of an examination of, I guess, maybe culture rather than, like, culture in relation to human condition rather than individual relations to the world around them.
Right. And that's what I'm saying, is that the internal experience to me does not necessarily have to be about a single person or a single experience. It's more the pluralistic. I think science fiction does, to an extent, you know, depending on what it's dealing with, for sure, have an incredible ability to explore an internal experience and produce an internal experience without ever even touching on characters. And I'm not sure. I'm sure there's fiction that can do that. I haven't read it yet, personally, but I haven't read that much either, to be honest, of straight fiction.
So yeah, me either.
It's something that, you know, I'm sure somebody else can talk about a little bit more intelligently than I can. But that is one of the things that I've found over the years in reading science fiction. I mean, just reading the Frank Herbert's Dune series, his exploration of the civilization, to me, you can get that beautiful internal experience just by examining the way that his societies function. His societies are almost a character in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
His history is a character in itself as it applies to the series. So the planets are characters, you know. So I think that might be a way that science fiction is really good at getting to an internal experience and in exploring beauty and being beautiful, is when somebody does it well, at least, you know, that exploration of the environment. I mean, it's actually, it is something that fiction can do, has done. If you look at, you know, Heart of Darkness. Well, in the sense that, shut up, it's a great book. I love it.
I can't stand that book.
You don't like Heart of Darkness? And I'm blanking on the author right now because I'm an idiot. Is that Conrad?
Conrad, yeah.
Okay.
Wait, I might be getting it confused with a different book, though.
Which one? Never mind. I'm not gonna.
Another. It's another book about India, but I can't.
Oh, Heart of Darkness isn't about India.
Yeah, then I'm confusing it with a different book. Excuse me.
About Africa.
Yeah, no, wrong book. I was thinking a book takes place in India, written by a British person, but I can't remember who wrote that.
Okay. Well, Heart of Darkness is very much about the environment that they're going into. You know, it's more. I mean, yes, you have characters and everything, and the characters are important, but the exploration of the jungle and the fact that the jungle takes on a life of its own and things like that is very important thematically to Heart of Darkness. And to actually, now that I'm thinking about it, quite a large number of fiction stories, environment plays a huge role in, I mean, like I said, there's the city in Dickens and like now there's the jungle and Heart of Darkness, and you find that all over the place. And it is definitely a way to explore, I guess, the human condition, that internal experience, because I think there's something meditative about those characters, quote unquote characters, when you're using the environment as a character.
Sure. I'm curious, because I'm thinking Heart of Darkness may be a book I have never read, but I feel like I should have read that book.
Yes, you should have.
Anyway, but is that a book that he wrote during in a point in which the conditions he's talking about socially are still in a way happening, or is it something that he wrote well after the conditions had ended, or at least come to a new plateau?
It was written while Europeans were. It was published in 1902, and it's about exploring the Congo.
Okay, so definitely still in the thick of colonialism then.
Yes. Still
okay.
Very much in the thick of colonialism, and
that does change then. It slightly changes how you consider the book, because if we're talking a straight historical novel, like say if it had been written, just for example, if it had been a book with a similar theme written in 1995, I'm gonna push it back even more. Let's just go 2000. A book written in 2000 that's talking about the same things. I think that our perspective of that book changes particularly in how we think about how it deals with the human condition, because of the fact that it's the Conrad book is written more or less in the middle. It's still dealing with historical subjects, but it's also dealing with conditions that are present. So it's an examination of literally of the present rather than talking about a past condition. Does that make sense?
It does.
And so I think it does change our perspective of the book. Not to say that either book is necessarily better. I mean, maybe, I don't know. I don't have an example.
Right. I mean, it's the same thing with Dickens. I mean, Dickens was, in terms of describing the city, he's within the thick of, you know, of Victorian England when he's writing his novels. And the city is very much, you know, a centerpiece of that.
And
I think both authors take it to logical extremes.
Well, I would say with them, both of them, yeah, they're pretty fairly, at least, well, they might have maybe been considered hyperbole at the time, but they are fairly logical extremes, sure. And then I'm thinking, just to throw out Mieville again, because he's going to get, 9,000 plugs from us now. but Mieville's then, you could almost, because I want to say he lives in London, but I'm not 100%, but I know he lives in England, and he likely lives in a city, or at least is within, if you're in England, you're within fairly easy access to a city, or at least something that resembles a city by England standards. So, I mean, he's even dealing with the present in a way, too.
Yeah, oh, very much so.
So what about science fiction, which is, people often argue, and I think they're right, that it is dealing with the present, but it's doing it by presenting situations that are no longer present. They're within our timeline, but they're completely separated by time. With Perdido, I guess you could say that, well, it's completely separated because it's not even the same world. Fine, okay. But the difference between Heart of Darkness is it's dealing with conditions that were happening then. It's all, you know, and so forth. And the same with the imaginary book, I imagine, in 2000 that's going back. It's dealing with stuff that's already happened. Science fiction is dealing with human conditions, but it's also talking about settings and things and whatnot that are no longer present, or theoretically aren't
longer
present.
Longer present or have not been present yet.
Right. Or maybe are not even within the cultural consciousness of society. You know, I mean, there are always science fiction stories that come up with new gadgets and stuff. And those are things that are just, they're so radically new, they haven't been conceived.
Right. No. I think we've actually talked about this before. I think science fiction is very much, to me, science fiction, I mean, really is just, it's fiction. It's just not set now.
Right. Well, it's not set now. It's about now, but it's set elsewhere.
It's very right, exactly. To me, science fiction and a lot of fantasy can be said to do the same thing. Is very much about now, although it's interesting because you know, and we were going to talk about it today if they'd been able to come on. But the lesbian steampunk anthology that we just read, I found it very interesting that they were, I mean, to me, one of the large, the big themes is feminism within this environment of Victorian stereotype, or Victorian gender roles.
Yeah, okay? And this is actually something that's related to another thing that was brought up, I want to say early December, but I'm not 100%, I'll try to find the post and link it, where people were criticizing steampunk for sort of ignoring its period that it's talking about entirely, because in Victorian period, that is massive imperialism and colonialism and empires formations, and yet there's almost no discussion in any steampunk stories about those. It's almost like they have gone back in time.
Well, what I found really interesting about the steampunk, the lesbian steampunk anthology, is that it, to me, it very much was not ignoring
gender issue,
gender issues and even colonial issues. I mean, there was a great story about Haiti, the woman who comes up from Haiti.
Is she was the one
the
that
spy.
Was like the spy? Oh, right, yeah. Right. And that, but that's alternate history in which Haiti,
right,
I guess, gets independence and becomes actually a, I wouldn't say superpower, but it's become
a force to be reckoned with.
I would say that it can hold its own, but it's certainly not going to be stopping the U.S. But it certainly has its own, yeah.
No, I thought it was fascinating. I mean, to be, you know, completely honest, they still, most of the women in these stories still have a lot more freedom than a woman in Victorian times actually had. Most women, vast majority of women. You have women who are very much free and independent in a lot of these stories.
Yeah.
But There are also a number of stories that pay very close attention to the fact that they are not free, and that the only way that some of them are free is because that they have, you know, like their fathers kind of, you know, give them a little bit extra room, wiggle room. Their fathers, not their mothers, because mothers don't have any power. So right. I thought that was really fascinating that they chose to really study the times of the genre that they were writing with, that they're writing within.
That is so fascinating, because now that I think about it, a lot of the stories are like that. There's a story, I want to say it's the same spy story, where the because it's a steampunk lesbian story, so there's stories about women who like women. And there's the one, where she's almost like she's under control of her brother.
Yes, exactly.
She is somewhat of a free spirit, and she can kind of wiggle out from under his grasp, mostly because he seems to be somewhat weak, but...
Exactly. Only when portrayed as weak is he, you know, is she capable of actually escaping his, I wouldn't even say his influence, but his ownership. I mean,
right.
Literal ownership.
Right. And of course, he seems to recognize her brilliance as well, because he sort of indulges her in her obsession with science.
Right. And then, but very specifically, because you have to use that term indulges, you know, and that's pretty much what happens within the Victorian realm. But anyway, what I'm getting to is, to me, some of these stories were absolutely beautiful in their ability to explore these very human experiences. But what I found really interesting was that I was trying to figure out kind of the relevance of that study, of studying something that is not contemporary to us at all. You know, it's at least within the United States, although it is still the experience of many women. I will not deny that. And the experience of women within very specific cultures within the United States, that they are still, even though legally they've got rights and everything, socially they still don't. Right. But anyway, it's still not quite, it's nowhere near as extreme as the lack of rights that are within these lesbian steampunk stories. So I was trying to figure out the relevance to people like me who are very much liberated. You know, I'm in a very equal marriage, you know, and whatnot.
Well,
well, I'm obviously superior. But beyond that,
your husband's gonna love that. Good job.
Right. You know, and it's lesbian steampunk. Steampunk is, you know, it's an alternate history. And so it's not in that sense specifically science fiction, although it does deal heavily with science.
It's like on the cusp between fantasy and, which is why I put alternate history into its own category.
I know.
Because I think it's difficult to, because you can't just say, well, all alternate history is science fiction. Because no, because there's alternate history from like the Byzantine era with magic. So, right. Yeah. But anyway.
Anyways. So, I actually really enjoyed the stories, and I thought they were beautiful. And, you know, the question is, why are they beautiful?
Well, that's interesting.
I think we've kind of gone away from this SF aesthetics in this discussion, but that's okay.
Well, I mean, to be fair, we're going to talk, we had already planned to talk about science fiction and fantasy.
Exactly.
All right, so that ends part one. Part two, like I said, will come up next week. Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Heart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.